Hello, Tyler. How you doing?
I am fine. Good to hear from you, as always.
It's good to hear from you. Thanks for coming on to Blogging Heads TV again. I am Will Wilkinson of the Cato Institute, and we have with us today Tyler Cowan, who is a professor of economics at George Mason University, one of the co-proprietors of the Marginal Revolution blog, and the author of the recently released book, Create Your Own Economy, The Path to Prosperity in a Disordered World. And we'll talk about your book today, Tyler. All right?
Great.
So let me start by asking you, I guess, to give your elevator pitch about what the book was about, but I wanted to just mention to get you started that I actually was surprised by what the book was about, what I predicted it would be about, given the title, was I thought I was going to learn something about how I could sort of create a sort of economic niche of my own.
Well, I think the book is about creating an economic niche of your own, but it's in the mm-hmm. space of the economy of attention rather than the economy of money.
Right. So I was assuming the economy of money rather than the economy of attention, I guess. So that's why it was surprising in some ways. And also, I wasn't expecting it to be largely a book about autism, which it deals with all through the book. Tell me a little bit about how you came to write this particular book, and what your project is in it, and kind of briefly your elevator speech about what the book is about.
Well, here's one way to view the elevator speech. Part of the book is an optimistic vision of the new information society, and it's about the value we're creating for ourselves by using the internet and using the web. It's a defense of all that against the view that Google is making us stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I also view the book as a kind of tribute to what I call human neurodiversity, which I think is a very underrated idea in the social sciences. It's also an underrated idea in business books and from a business and economics point of view. More specifically, the book uses autism and the information processing abilities of autistics to shed light what's going on in society more generally. So in part, the book is arguing that non-autistics are using technology to mimic a lot of cognitive advantages of the autistic brain. Part of this endeavor is actually to outline to people that autism is not just, by definition, some series of impairments or problems, but there's another notion of autism as a cognitive profile, which involves a lot of cognitive strengths. Now, I don't actually think that counts as an elevator speech. I'm not sure this is an elevator speech book.
No.
But that's what it's about. It's about how we ought to be more open to appreciating different intelligences.
Mm-hmm.
I think in an indirect way, perhaps, but it is very much also a business book and an economics book. It just doesn't look like one because, again, it's operating in these alternative spaces.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about the idea of neurodiversity in general, and then autism in particular. So in the beginning of the book, you reveal that your interest in the topic has something to do with your discovery that you're somewhere on the autism spectrum. Can you say something about that? And also the politics of the usage of the language is interesting to get out at the beginning, because when you're talking about autism, you're not talking about what a lot of people think of as a disorder, right? And a lot of people, and there's a distinction that's fairly conventional between like Asperger's syndrome, which is people think of as a high functioning autistic who is perfectly capable of doing the things that everyone else does, maybe even a little bit better. But autism is reserved for people who have some sort of serious problem that acts as a real disability. And you decline to make that distinction. And so I'd like to hear a little bit about why.
Well, let me start with the first question. We need to be very careful when we talk about the autism spectrum. If you talk about the formal definition of the spectrum that you find in diagnostic manuals, I would not count as being on the autism spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
I do think I have autistic cognitive features in the following sense, that I can absorb information at a rate that is really quite a bit higher than even people, I think, of who would be as smart as I am can do. And this has been a big advantage to me, and it's something I was trying to figure out when I wrote the book. So in terms of, you know, what it means for a person to be on the autism spectrum, no one really agrees on the definition of what that is. So I would just inject that as a cautionary note. You ask about the difference between autism and Asperger's. The Asperger's concept was really coined in 1981 by Lorna Wing, and a lot of people view that history as the fact simply that some people started doing things or achieving things that autistics supposedly could not do, and as a result, a new category had to be coined. But I think that's scientifically not really the best way to go. It's common practice to define autism in terms of outcomes, like does a person have a particular series of impairments, starting with social communication, but not restricted to that. I think when autism is defined that way, there are two problems with that. One is an ethical problem. You're taking a whole group of people and just defining them as a bunch of people who don't do well or can't do well or won't do well. But I think there's also a scientific problem that if you prejudge the question of what autistics or other people are capable of learning, that should not be an a priori decision. So it seems to me a more consistent approach is to think in terms of the cognitive profile, at least definitionally leave the question open as to what the outcomes will look like. I think in the real world, what one observes is a high variance of outcomes, some very bad life outcomes, and also a lot of good life outcomes. And when you view it in those terms, when you view it as a cognitive profile, and you then try to ask, what's the difference between autism and Asperger's, it's much harder to define. The common sense view is something like, well, autistics are the people who do really badly, and Asperger's are the people who do okay. But I think that's a mistaken approach to the whole concept. Does that get at your question?
Yeah, that's perfect. That's exactly what I was asking about. And one of the things that was sort of new to me was, I mean, that it was useful to learn was to think of this cognitive profile that you that you mentioned as containing a lot of different possibilities. So you can take, you can have two different people with aspects of the autistic cognitive profile, and they might both count as autistic in some sense, but they can be completely different, right?
Absolutely.
And so we have a lot of variation among the kinds of people who, you know, we'd count as autistic in some sense. And that, and I guess that brings us to the bigger point, that even within the category of people with an autistic cognitive profile, there's a lot of variance and individuality. And that sort of highlights the extent to which there is what you call neurodiversity. So maybe you could say something more about just the idea of neurodiversity itself, and what you think that means. Well, the whole book is about what you think that means, and we'll get to some of that. But say a little bit something about neurodiversity.
Well, I view the book as a whole as a defense of individualism. And when you think about human neurology in terms of this cognitive profile, rather than like defining it in terms of good or bad outcomes, I think you get a much richer appreciation for the different kinds of intelligences out there, how important they are, and how difficult it is in the usual ways to stereotype them. And when you ask me about neurodiversity, the most commonly understood other examples of neurodiversity would be something called ADHD, which a lot of laymen don't even think exists, but I actually very much do think it exists. Tourette syndrome, but I think there's just a lot of neurodiversity that hasn't been formally studied yet, and it exists in individual lives, and that's what I mean when I say it's an underappreciated concept.
Yeah, I just reading the book.
Yeah, even in the literature on autism, there are a lot of debates like, is there just autism? Are there different kinds of autism?
Yeah.
If people have what's called Fragile X syndrome, is that the same as, you know, classical autism and so on? No matter what your point of view on those questions, they're extremely complicated, and a lot of them are still viewed as fairly open.
Yeah, it's impossible to read Create Your Own Economy without thinking about yourself, right? You're like, it pushes you into thinking about how your own cognitive style or sort of overall psychological style is unique. And that's a fascinating question, especially for those of us who are narcissistic and like to think about ourselves a lot. but the idea, I mean, so on the regular test, so after reading your book, I was like, am I on the autism scale? And I took like three different quizzes online, and I'm not at all. Just don't even approach the autistic scale. But I'm also...
I should warn you, those quizzes are very misleading. I'm not trying to suggest, Will, that you're autistic. But if anyone out there is taking those quizzes, I would say, overall, don't take them very seriously. Because those quizzes are based on the notion of autism being a kind of personality profile.
Yeah.
So, for instance, it's assumed that autistics are introverted people. But when you view it as a cognitive profile, I believe actually a lot of autistics are quite extroverted. That sounds very counterintuitive. They're not extroverted in the sense that their behavior necessarily is the behavior of what we think of as extroverted people, but they may have a personality temperament that is, in a way, extroverted or wanting to be extroverted. It may just be hard for them to somehow realize or to satisfy that operating in what is largely a non-autistic society.
Yeah, well, that's one of the interesting one of the things that I hadn't thought about very much in terms of these kind of feedback loops between other people's cognitive styles and the way you end up behaving. So I might be an incredibly sociable person and love being around people and love having a lot of company, but if I'm not the best at reading subtle social cues, being in the company of a certain kind of people might make me feel really uncomfortable. I might feel like I might be missing something important, and so my desire to be around people might be stymied a little bit about my sense that I'm not able to relate in the normal way. And I hadn't really quite thought about it in that way. And I was fascinated by your accounts of the conventions of autistics and the flourishing subculture of autism based discussion groups on the internet that exhibit a high level of interest in sociality, but on terms that are just different than the typical social interaction.
That's right. The person who cleared up a lot of these distinctions for me was a woman named Michelle Dawson, who was herself autistic, which I think is interesting. But she and Laurent Motron and some other researchers in Montreal are the people who have fleshed out this notion of autism as a cognitive profile. I think that's very important work, and I think it has a lot more general implications for appreciating the diversity of human beings and the importance of an individualistic perspective. So part of what I wanted to do in the book was to communicate that in a more systematic way.
Yeah, so say a little bit more about what characterizes the autistic cognitive profile, and then we can move on to talking about how sort of the modern technology and the modern economy increases the demand for certain kinds of cognitive traits characteristic of that profile.
Well, again, I would stress a lot of this is recent research, and it's still up for grabs exactly which are the relevant features. But I think what I focus on in the book is this extreme interest in a certain kind of information processing, which has to do with assembling small bits of information. It's not small bits at the expense of the larger picture necessarily, but that there's interest in varying levels of the architectonic structure of information, and the idea of collecting, enumerating, ordering, classifying information as being something that's just downright fun and interesting and important. I'm not sure I want to say that is the essential element of an autistic cognitive profile, but it's the element that I focus upon because I think it's the one most important for understanding the modern information economy and also for understanding the world more generally. But there are a lot of other features of autistic cognitive profiles that one can talk about, and they come up in other parts of the book. So some researchers, for instance, argue that autistics are less likely to think in terms of stereotypical narratives, and they're more likely to have an accurate memory for certain kinds of facts. That would be an example of another autistic cognitive feature that I talk about.
Yeah, when you're the point about the objectivity of sort of narrative memory, what reminded me of, there's this whole, you know, literature that I'm sure you've heard of about, like, depressive realism,
sure.
where people who are suffering from various kinds of depressive disorders, their self-assessments tend to be more accurate and objective, and their evaluation of how well they did in a particular episode, it tends to be more objective. And it sort of sounded like that aspect of the autistic cognitive profile gives you the kind of realism of a depressed person without the depression, and that would be valuable, right? Like to have that kind of unblinkered, you know, not overly, you know, distorted by, you know, your sunny hopefulness, but not have it be driven by the fact that you're, you know, you're sad.
It's a very interesting economic study, which I discuss in the book, and they put autistics through what we call in economics, economic experiments,
mm-hmm.
and it turned out the autistics had much smaller framing effects in terms of how they perceive the asymmetry of perceived gains and perceived losses, and they came much closer to making what would normally be considered the correct decisions.
Yeah, so like,
that's only one experiment.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see it replicated, but to me it's highly suggestive. It's consistent with my intuitions, which is that there are some cognitive profiles which predispose people towards greater objectivity along particular dimensions. Not necessarily all dimensions, but at least some.
Yeah, so the experiment you're talking about, was it an experiment about the endowment effect?
I would call it, what's framing, what's the endowment mm-hmm. effect? There's actually a mm-hmm. little bit of confusion of that in the literature
mm-hmm.
itself. But it's a way in which the autistic people in the experiment saw through to the underlying economic reality more clearly than did the non-autistics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a bit about, so one of the themes that comes up early on in the book, which is really interesting and important, is the importance of framing. There's this giant literature in economics and law and econ and in psychology about the way context, the context in which people make decisions can affect the decisions that they make in ways that people aren't necessarily aware of. And you make the case that that to some extent, like, framing is something that's up to us, that we can make decisions about what kinds of context we're going to put ourselves in. And I found that, like, a fascinating argument, that this just adds a more abstract level of choice. If we know that there's a certain kind of context or a certain kind of frame in which my decision-making will tend to be biased in a particular way, then that's information I can use about what kind of context I want to put myself in.
Yeah, behavioral economics is typically negative about framing effects. There's something to be overcome, maybe nudging people, taxing people, forcing people, whatever. While I do think framing effects can be negative or dangerous, I wanted to show a much more positive side of framing effects. They're a big part of what give our lives meaning. So try taking a movie that you think is wonderful and walking in and just watching the last 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
The movie will actually seem pretty crummy because whatever is going on the screen, it's not framed for you in a meaningful way. So we can view Facebook and Twitter and a lot of what's done on the web as basically creating narratives, creating contexts, giving us framings for things just making sense to us, being fun, being suspenseful. And in general, when you view framing effects this way, you don't want to get rid of them in all cases. What you want to do is get as many of the good framing effects as you can and try to avoid some of the bad framing effects. And I think that's a healthier perspective.
Yeah. I mean, it's an argument that I like to make. One response that you can make to people like Robert Frank, who talk about the way other people's consumption choices affect our frame of reference for what we take to be, you know, an adequate car or an adequate house. So there's a certain kind of frame for your consumption choices that's built by other people's consumption choices, and you can see people as kind of victims without agency if there are some rich people buying bigger houses that shift the frame of reference for an adequate house up. But individuals do have the agency to say, decide where they're going to live, for one thing.
Sure, right? You can drop out of these races. And I think in general, framing effects are fun. The pursuit of different kinds of relative status very often is fun. Not always, and it's not always fun for the losers. I understand that. But if you look at Frank himself, he's worked very hard, and he's at a top university, and he's achieved all kinds of honors and awards, which he's deserved. And I don't know Bob that well, but I suspect it was a good deal of fun for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that his gain is directly canceled out by the people who ended up choosing other professions because they couldn't make it as top economists the way he has. I think there's a big net gain, and the people who ended up losing that race actually ended up, you know, winning some other what you might call relative status contests, and that it's a positive-sum game, and that if we didn't have these contests and framing effects, our lives would have a lot less meaning, is my view.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm much more optimistic about that whole process.
Yeah, and it seems to me that that's one of the major tasks of meaning making in life is to challenge frames that are just sort of given to you by your culture and to push against them and create different contexts for your own life. That's one of the things that makes the choices that you make meaningful is that you've embedded them within a broader context that is in some sense yours. And
that's right. And the web is amazingly flexible for helping us do that in new ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big reason why I think we're underestimating its benefits.
Let's talk about the web a little bit more about it. It's how it fits into your thesis about how it's helping some people or encourages some of us to think in ways that are more characteristic of the autistic style. But I just had one more thought, like about the framing effects, right? How about getting married, right? Like, you're reframing your entire life.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and everything you do takes on a different cast. And there are real economic consequences, say, to getting married, probably because your set of incentives changes pretty systematically based on that kind of relationship that you've entered into. Now, that's something you can choose to enter into or not choose to enter into. But if you do, then it kind of reframes all your choices. It puts them all in a different context.
And your whole sense of what creates meaning changes, or at least it ought to change. Usually it does.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be married soon, Will. We'll see.
Yeah. And similarly with like the friends that you choose to be around, that they can restructure the way a lot of your experiences seem. That if you have a friend who's particularly interested in certain things and you care about that person, you might start paying attention to those things in a way that you didn't before. And that really changes your experience and
That's right.
reframes it. So anyway, I love that thought of in some sense, having control over the frame in which you act. So tell me more about how the internet is changing the way we think and the kind of thinking that it's encouraging.
Well, I think a common criticism is that the internet is just about multitasking and making everyone more impatient, and we flit from one thing to the other. I view this process as having a lot more coherence than do the critics. I think you assemble a stream of daily experience and you pursue a set of stories and narratives, and it's really quite suspenseful. You want to know what's going to happen next with your favorite people, your favorite writers, the debates you follow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this rich inner stream or this blend of meaning that we assemble. And I think this is displacing to some extent some of what you might call, you know, mainstream culture, whether it be high culture or television or whatever. These stories we're creating, and I think very often they're a lot more fun. I was on the phone last night with a reporter, and I said to her, she was complaining that she, quote-unquote, wasted time on Facebook and Twitter. And I said, you're pursuing stories. Why is it that you think the stories of your own life are so much worse than the stories in whatever novel you think you ought to be reading instead? I said, especially once you get past the best 50 or 100 novels, to just pick up some, like, median, indie, intelligent, like new out, smart people are talking about it, sort of novel, but not a great world classic of all time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are the stories in there so much better, more interesting, more meaningful than the actual real stories of your life and the lives of your friends? And I don't think they are. I think actually I convinced her. So this new web culture, if culture is even the right word, that's something I want to celebrate. But the other point I would make is we also use the web to be very long-term in our orientations, not just to be short-term. So take something like Google. You can use Google to find information very quickly. That frees up some of your time for longer run projects. But Google also helps you follow things over very long time horizons. So if you have, say, a favorite rock star that you've been following for 30 years, or if you want to follow debates on global warming or egalitarianism or whatever, you use Google to do that. So it's very easy now to follow a topic for a year, 5 years, 10 years. You don't have to be geographically close to it. You don't have to be an insider. So to have a long-running interest and always be up to speed on it is today much easier and far more possible than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way in which internet culture, it's not just about short-term and immediate gratification. It's also supporting, you know, long-run intense commitments.
Yeah. Well, the point about following the stories of your friends and following the story of the development of different issues, I mean, that really rang true to me, partly because I've just moved from D.C. to Iowa, but because of the extent to which I'm embedded in the internet really made that change in context less dramatic than it might have otherwise been. Because the means through which I was following the stories of, like, all my friends and you know, my frenemies and, you know, just all the people in the D.C. policy and journalism world who I consider an acquaintance or whose work I'm interested in, my main means of following all that didn't change. I still, like...
That's right. I still follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, so I follow their Twitter updates. I follow their Facebook updates. I read their blogs. And the difference is that I don't get to see them as often face to face, and that's an important difference. It's a profound difference. And the people that I do see face to face in Iowa City are a very different kind of person. So something about, you know, my frame has changed a lot, but it changed a lot less than it would have just 10 years ago. And so I've got a certain sense of social continuity that I wouldn't have otherwise had. And that's fascinating because that helps you realize that at one level you're more free to move where you'd like to be without actually losing all your friends or losing access to the stream of stories about them that is part of your own internal life.
When you see people that you know, even if they still feel like your friends, they're not starting from scratch. You don't have to walk through some kind of list. Here are the 7 things that are new with me since we last met.
Mm-hmm.
These people are more or less up to speed. They may even know what book you've been reading, what concert you've seen. So you pick up with them, you know, much more like that in an instant, and it's more real and more immediate. It's more visceral, actually.
Yeah.
So this way in which the internet complements the visceral, emotional nature of our lives is an idea I very much wanted to push in the book. It's about emotional connection.
Now, what do you say to... So here's the main criticism that I can think of this line of thinking is, at some level, this feels like a kind of alienation, and it seems kind of inauthentic or something like that. So the line of thinking would be that our real sources of meaning, or what ought to be our sources of meaning, are local, that we ought to be deeply and richly embedded in our local communities, with our next door neighbors, with the people that are, the parents of the kids that my kids go to school with, right? Like, I should be intimate with those people, and the sources of meaning in my life ought to be my, you know, thick, you know, not deeply rooted connectedness with the place where I am and the community there. And this kind of, like, following people half a world away on Facebook is a way of it's not free. That's the time you're spending on Facebook is time you're not spending at a PTA meeting, maybe.
Thank goodness, yes.
So it seems like this is a mechanism by which we can become more and more detached from our localities and our local communities, and that leaves us in some sense, and especially our communities, poor. How do you respond?
It doesn't have to be about detachment. If you think of your own situation, to continue with that example, it will be much easier for you to marry and be together with your partner because you can connect with others at a distance. So it's very much strengthening what is your most important thick tie, That would be just a simple point. But another is, it may be that we really want to have, you know, close, thick, durable ties with people who are, you know, very particular in some way, or have particular interests, or a particular kind of personality, or a particular cognitive profile for that matter. And the internet is the way you find them. So to get something, you know, truly that fits you, or is what you want, is what they want, it's not necessarily the seven people who live next door to you in the house where you were born, or even the 150 people who would have been in your tribe and hunter-gatherer society. You have a new potential for long-lasting thick ties. So the internet's all about diversity. Clearly, people use it to flit around and be superficial. But this other side of the story, the more durable, thicker, more emotional, more connected side, is what I feel we're overlooking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the your idea that the you know, contemporary economy, especially the information economy, that aspect of our economy, that encourages and rewards certain elements of the autistic cognitive style, and therefore some of the education that we are getting, that people who, you know, don't naturally have an autistic cognitive style, what we need and what we're getting is training in how to be a little more autistic in a certain sense.
Sure. I would just say the word profile, I think, is better than style, because style implies it's more a matter of choice than it might be for a lot of people.
Okay.
So I would say autistic cognitive profile. But I think, you know, one clear pattern we find in the autistic cognitive profile is extreme focus on particular areas.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very often discussed as if it's just a kind of pathology. But it doesn't have to be. It can be extremely useful. It can be extremely productive. And Adam Smith, a long time ago, wrote a book about the division of labor and basically glorified this with qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
But people who are very good at some things and not so good at other things, people who are more cognitively specialized, which tends to describe autistics, you would expect that on average they do better in a society with more division of labor. And that's one of the arguments of my book. That one thing, I think even Smith himself saw this in some fashion, the division of labor mobilizes human neurodiversity in a way which is extremely powerful and often overlooked by economists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fascinating point.
And I don't just mean autistics there. There are just people who are really good at some things and really bad at other things.
Mm-hmm.
It includes a lot of autistics, but it's a very general point. And then there are people who are more jacks of all trades.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, we're favoring the people who are in some ways specialized.
Yeah. I just think that that's a profound point. I mean, it's like it's actually hard for me to wrap my head around. But, you know, as the division of labor, you know, deepens and specialization, the returns to specialization, you know, increase, niches open up for more and more kinds of people. That the menu of jobs, if you think of, you know, there's, you know, all these models in, you know, labor economics about, you know, matching workers to jobs. And if there's only five kinds of jobs, but 20 kinds of people, then there's going to be lots of mismatches, right?
That's right.
And if there are a proliferating number of kinds of jobs, then the probability that an individual at random is going to be able to find something that suits their, you know, distinctive, you know, neurological profile has gone up. And so that is a really interesting rebuttal to one of Adam Smith's own arguments, right? That Adam Smith worries deeply that the division of labor and that specialization in particular will be sort of soul-killing. That if all you're doing is, you know, shaving, you know, the tips off of little pieces of metal to make pins all day long, that's completely stultifying for anybody, really. And that's something that Marx picks up on later, is just the completely, you know, just soul-crushing nature of monotonous, specialized labor. And there's obviously something right about that argument, but it misses this other thing that you're talking about, and I think that's fascinating.
No, I view division of labor as supporting human authenticity. Imagine if we lived in Smith's time and I had to end up with a job working on a farm. I think I would actually feel pretty alienated and pretty unhappy. I'm not sure how I do working on a farm, but I'm pretty sure I prefer what it is I'm doing now. So the division of labor, and in particular the internet, I think it's making us all more like who we really are in a way which on net I view as fulfilling and again supporting authenticity. And I think that point is overlooked even in discussions of the division of labor subsequent to Smith. It hasn't really gotten enough play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes at Cato, interns will say, you've got the job that I want. How do you get that job? And I don't have an answer for them because I don't know what my job is. You know, my job is they're just paying me to do things that I happen to enjoy and happen to be relatively good at. And so, you know, I can't tell somebody to be good at the same things that I'm good at. That's how you get my job. I would just tell them to be good at the things that you're good at and see what jobs you get. And
for you to be good at what you do, you need a very particular cognitive profile, which it turns out you have. You're probably better suited to do what you're doing than to be an academic, which, of course, you could have chosen.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a sense in you, this desire for an immediate connection to debates in the real world that you have, that I think, in a way, pushes you away from academic life. Is essential to working at Cato, and so many philosophers don't have that. And when you put together all the parts of your profile which make you fit, it really requires a lot of different things for you to be successful in what you're doing. To be, say, you know, very good at communicating with other people, very clear speaker, very good debater, I might add, and so on.
Well, that's all kind of you, but I think it gets to the more general point that there's a. That it's possible to, everybody doesn't have the same, set of advantages growing up. So everybody doesn't have the same set of opportunities. But the possibility of doing something that's sort of uniquely suited to you, I think, has gone up partly because of new technologies. But I'd also mention, and this is an interesting thing too, And I don't mean to talk about me, but I know most about me.
Let's talk about you.
So I'll just use myself as an example. But I feel like I have certain strengths that lend themselves to my doing what I'm doing. But at the same time, a lot of things that are just demands of my job and most jobs in the kind of economy we have are things that I really struggle with. But I'm diagnosed as having ADHD. I don't know what it means in terms of the neurological underpinnings of it. But I suspect that things like ADD, so that kind of neurodiversity, the thing that bothers me, and I think it bothers you, and bothers me in the same way it bothers you, in thinking of autism as a disorder, is that attention deficit disorder. I don't think that I really, really just don't have a sense of myself as having a disorder. What I have a sense of is a kind of ecological mismatch. That's
right, exactly, and I feel the same way.
Mm-hmm. So my job, it really is customized to me in an incredible way. But there's still some things that are non-optional. I have to make deadlines. I have to produce so much stuff, and my ability to just do work on command or to focus in a very intense way is very, very difficult. And so it causes me a lot of anxiety and a lot of stress. But it's not. I don't think I have a disorder. It's just that I'm not well matched to those demands. But those demands are going to be out there, and so I have to learn to cope with them in one way or another. And I think it's something that's actually been unhelpful about modern psychiatry and psychology to try to think of anything that is a mismatch between a person's psychology and the needs of the sort of socioeconomic structure as evidence of a disorder rather than evidence of just a poor fit.
No, I've been reading papers lately on ADHD, and I'm surprised by the overall low level of quality in them, or just question-begging assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm even at the point where I wonder if ADHD is not a cognitive advantage on net. I think a lot of people take what is considered attention deficit, and I would not use that phrase, but they learn how to use it as a kind of mechanism to propel them from one kind of learning to another. And they're perpetually active, learning things, soaking in information, and doing something useful with it in a way that people who are not, quote-unquote, ADD, mm-hmm. Whatever that might mean, cannot do. There was a recent study on entrepreneurship supported by the Kauffman Foundation, and it found that entrepreneurs are more likely than average to have dyslexia.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing it found is that people who have dyslexia, they're extremely good at delegating authority to others because they know they can't micromanage everything. They have a lot of cognitive strengths, and the things you would think are their weaknesses, there are ways in which they can act to either learn to overcome them or somehow adjust or compensate for them. So the whole word disorder as applied to any of these areas, I think we should be extremely cautious in applying it. We shouldn't deny there are people who are very troubled by circumstances and try to help those people.
Mm-hmm.
But calling those people a disorder isn't really actually helping them at all.
No, and
I think we're just scratching the surface in terms of understanding ADHD and autism and how it relates not just to the lives of people who might like serve as, you know, poster children, but like people you actually encounter in your life and how it feeds into the productivity of American business,
mm-hmm.
information technology, scientific advance. I think we're really at a very rudimentary stage in understanding this. And one of the big things I wanted to do with my book was just, you know, scream and wake people up. Look, there's a question here. We're all just assuming this is disorder, but it's actually, you know, one of the big stories of human society, in my view.
Yeah, that I think that's the core of the book, and it's one of the most fascinating things about it. Let's talk a little bit more about stories. I really liked this chapter. You talk about one of my favorite papers. Your dissertation advisor at Harvard, Thomas Schelling, wrote this amazing essay called "The Mind as a Consuming Organ," and you talk about you put a pretty heavy emphasis on the importance of being able to craft narratives, but at the same time, you think that there are important limits to stories, to depending, to basing your identity heavily on a narrative or on a set of stories. And I found that illuminating, so I wanted to get you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, we can start with public policy. I think a big problem behind voting behavior is voters remember things in terms of stories, with good guys, bad guys, very simple narratives. That can be great for watching, you know, blockbuster Hollywood movies, but if you're trying to understand a complex public policy issue, it becomes far too simplified. I think it's one of the most important biases in human cognition. For all the work in behavioral economics, it's one that I think is understudied by economists, that most people, especially non-autistics, they tend to convert information into story form. You see it in the case of religions. Religions tend to be story-based. And again, it has big advantages. It's easy to remember because of our nature. But again, you're going to simplify. They're going to be heroes and villains. And it's very dangerous. It's a kind of form of self-deception. And just to raise some of these limits to storytelling, I think, is very important. We need to be very cautious about our propensity to tell stories to ourselves, even though it's a great joy, and it's often an efficient way of keeping information at your fingertips. But it's distorting the information at the same time.
Yeah, I just recorded a dialogue with Kurt Anderson, who is a novelist and a journalist, writes for Vanity Fair, used to be the editor-in-chief of New York, and he has this book called Reset that we talked about, which is, the lessons that we can learn from the big financial disaster, the economic downturn we're going through. And I mentioned this to him, that one of the problems that I had with the book was partly because it had a narrative structure to me that just seemed too enticing to be true, where the narrative structure is that we've gone through a period of kind of gluttony and decadence and overconsumption, and now we're experiencing the reckoning. Right now, I feel like that's a really natural and profound, you know, that's a kind of
thousands of years old.
Yeah.
You find it in the Bible,
yeah,
among many other places.
That's a story that hits home. Like, we recognize that story. We became decadent, and now the chickens are coming home to roost. But when I'm reading about like the actual mechanisms that led to the collapse of the financial sector, I don't see that story. You know, like the failure of the ratings agencies, or the oligopoly that the government granted the rating agencies, for instance, that doesn't fit into a narrative of the American consumer becoming, you know, a decadent glutton.
That's right.
It's a different story, but it's a harder story to tell. And when I write columns for the week, or you get 900 words, or maybe 1,000, and it's hard to write a true story in 1,000 words, that you end up leaning on these narrative tropes, these kind of story arcs that we've already internalized and recognized. But most of the time, when you tell a story with one of those pre-written arcs, it's just a lie. It's not really the story.
That's right, and I'd like people to be more aware of that. I think my own book, Create Your Own Economy, it's not written in classic story mode. There are particular stories, but the information in the book is organized in a somewhat different way. And, you know, it's an interesting question how readers will respond to that. I think it's a clearly written book.
Mm-hmm.
Things are explained in a direct way, but at the same time, the sense of looking for a story with parts of that story in every chapter, it's not exactly what the book is.
No, you've got there's a common set of themes that ran through it, but each chapter is in some ways, you know, self-contained. And each one of them is a kind of exploration of a slightly different set of ideas.
That's right.
That overall create a big picture, but I couldn't explain to somebody. This is why you probably said you didn't have an elevator story in this sense, is that you can't just summarize it in a simple way, that a lot of it is provocative and trying to get you to think new thoughts, and so it doesn't, because it doesn't fit into a familiar story arc, it's hard to explain to somebody who hasn't already read it in some ways. Let's see.
Malcolm Gladwell is a great storyteller as a writer.
Yes, he's fantastic. I described to somebody that I felt like Create Your Own Economy was like a Malcolm Gladwell book if Malcolm Gladwell wasn't such a good storyteller and was actually really smart.
Mm-hmm. I think I'll take that as a compliment.
It was, because it's full of aha moments. You're like, I hadn't thought of that before. But they don't fall out of these little potted narratives. Here's comparing the story of, you know, a business executive in Kansas City and a hairdresser and a bunch of guys at the Naval Observatory, and everything that they're doing supports this one hypothesis that I have. It doesn't have that kind of structure. But I found it compulsively readable. So I hope people take that to heart.
Well, thank you.
It was hard to put down, even though it wasn't written in the style of books that attempt to be hard to put down. But let's talk about, like, toward the end of the book is some of the most profound reflections. So I really enjoyed the chapter on beauty, which I think really gets to a lot of the upshot of the idea of the relationship between neurodiversity and individuality. So your claim in your chapter 8 is beauty isn't what you think it is. So what is it? Why isn't it what we think it is?
The chapter on beauty, to me, is the best chapter in the book, though I think it may be the chapter the smallest number of people will understand. But it tries to lay out how much beauty is relative to neurology, and it looks at the literature on who likes what kind of music. And a lot of that is sociological, so people go to the opera for reasons of status, or maybe because they heard classical music when they were a young kid and they learned how to like it. But a lot of it, I think, is just plain old neurology. So some people have neurologies where they don't really enjoy music much at all. Other people have neurologies where they're quite comfortable with very information-intensive music that to others sounds like screechy or unpleasant. Mm-hmm. So personally, I'm a big fan of atonal music, serialism, 12-tone music, those classes of approaches. And I'm well aware that to the clear majority of listeners, not only are they not interested, but they're actively hostile toward those styles. And for a long time, 20 years, I think I've been thinking about the question, how can it be that I like this stuff and they don't like it? And I spend all my time reading in aesthetics, trying to find mm-hmm. an answer to this question, and I failed. But when I read some of the empirical work on neurology and music, it struck me, I think there are basically people who have cognitive profiles, probably from birth, who are able to enjoy this music. It's inevitably a minority taste. It will never be that popular. But for those people, this is truly wonderful music. And it's a way of thinking about beauty. It's also a way of thinking about some perspectives on autism, that one thing that differentiates autistics from non-autistics is, I think, different ways in which they perceive matters aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of autistics will say that they feel they find more beauty in life than do non-autistics, or they find beauty in different ways, and they don't want to give that up. And if you ask them, like, do you want a quote-unquote cure for autism or Asperger's or whatever, they'll say no. And this notion that they have this different aesthetic perspective, which those are some of the ideas I try to communicate in that chapter.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the best chapter too, and it's the most has the most profound implication. So what one of the things that it made me think about were some of the more sophisticated theories of both aesthetic and moral value, which is that aesthetic properties or moral properties are what are sometimes called response dependent. That the goodness or beauty, what that is a property of the external thing that tends to create a certain response in an observer.
That's right.
And I think there's something quite right about that, that there's something I like a lot about response-dependent theories of value. But in order for them to be normative in a very strong way, you need to assume a lot of uniformity in listeners, or a lot of uniformity in the observers of human action. If different individuals have different dispositions to respond in different ways, because of, say, different neurologies, then some properties that are you're right to call them beautiful, because they do tend to create a particular kind of response on people constituted in a particular way, but they really might not be beautiful to anyone. That so response dependence theories really are relativistic theories insofar
Absolutely.
As they're based on the property, the status of the property is based on the observer. It's relative to the observer. And so if we've got lots of different neurologies, we might end up with a kind of value pluralism or just value relativism, where there's some things that are genuinely valuable to some people but aren't valuable to other people. And I think that has a lot of implications for a decent politics, a decent idea of the respect that's owed to food or to music or art that you don't personally like.
And that connects to how I view this as an individualistic book, a defense of individualism. I'll also say I went back and I reread David Hume on aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read Hume through this lens, I believe he understood it fully. I was shocked at how clear it was in a way, even though I'd read those essays by Hume 5 or 6 times before, but I never understood them in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And this heterogeneity point, it's there very clearly. He says, at times he sounds like he's someone writing on cognitive autism, that human beings differ in the extent to which they can perceive fine gradations in quality or experience, and that this is a fundamental fact of human existence and a fundamental fact for aesthetics. And it's right there on the page.
Mm-hmm.
Hume, along with Kant, is maybe the most famous writer on aesthetics ever, or with Plato.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel that anyone's really brought this out from Hume at all.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they have. One like implication of that. I mean, I think Hume's essay of the standard of taste is, I mean, it's one of my favorite things that anybody's ever
Phenomenal,
written.
Phenomenal. Yeah.
And the influence that had on me was profound. I mean, to the extent to which my own view of, say, like intellectual life was influenced by it, where I consider questions about difficult intellectual issues, I think of them as somehow having to do with taste. I have a notion of like epistemic taste, that there are certain arguments that taste wrong, right? They just,
exactly.
Because you don't necessarily explicitly see the logical structure of an argument, but you're like, there's something wrong with this. And a lot of what you do when you're trained in a discipline, whether it's philosophy or economics, is that you're cultivating a kind of epistemic taste, because it's not like you're not implementing an algorithm to tell whether a certain policy argument violates a fundamental principle of economics. You have to develop what people call economic intuition, right? But
that's right.
But what is that? And it feels like what you have when you can taste the elements in a good Merlot. Oh, there's a little bit of blackberry in there. And I don't.
Economics and politics are much more about taste and aesthetics, I think, than often we have realized. And there are thinkers that see that when you go back in the history of ideas. They're not always the most salubrious thinkers, but there's a lot to it. Mm-hmm. So the notion of how aesthetic, political, and economic perspectives somehow intersect or might ever agree, it's a question I've thought about and tried to write on really for the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a profound set of issues. Well, you brought up politics. Let's talk about that. One of your last chapters is on autistic politics. So give us a quick rundown of what you take, autistic politics to mean.
Well, two of the cognitive features of autism, one is this possibility of greater objectivity across certain kinds of decisions, and we don't exactly know what is the domain there. But I think of autistics as people who in general are not obsessed with revenge. Revenge is something that's narrative, and it's a kind of emotional imprinting of information that I see as occurring in a weaker manner in autistics. I tend to see autistics as naturally born cosmopolitans. If someone is autistic or quasi-autistic or somewhat autistic, whatever, however one wants to think or talk about it, but they grow up with the sense of being different, and to then tell such a person, well, the real differences are defined by national boundaries, I think usually they're pretty naturally skeptical of that idea. So this notion of autistics as natural born cosmopolitans, I think, is very important. And it's another way in which there's this cognitive or perceptual strength in autism that we don't find enough of in non-autistics.
Mm-hmm. You also stress the, in addition to like the natural-born cosmopolitanism, the ability to grasp the functioning of kind of abstract systems, which leads you to say that there's something about autistic politics that inclines people toward more general explanations, appreciation for, say, the rule of law. Can you say something about that?
Yes, Simon Baron Cohen uses the phrase systematizer. Mm-hmm. He views autistics as naturally born systematizers. I'm not sure that's exactly the right way of conceptualizing it, but you just go with that for the moment, since his theory is quite well known. It implies you'll have a lot of autistics who devote themselves to understanding the operation of highly abstract systems. So principles-laden political points of view, I think, will have an over-representation of autistics in them, whether it be, you know, consistent progressivism or libertarianism or a lot of other different views. Mm-hmm. The notion that there's a person who, like, just wakes up in the morning and believes in the status quo and gets it all from TV, I think you're a lot less likely to find that. And you're more likely to find some interest in, like, re-examining what are the fundamental principles of, like, ethics and science and politics. But I don't think it makes autistics, you know, any particular partisan point of view. I think it just leads to a kind of style of political thinking, which I very much like.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting to the extent that I would love to see a study on the distribution of people with, autistic traits or who have, you know, many of the traits in an autistic cognitive profile, what sort of fields in academia they are most likely to end up in. And I would guess that it would be, maybe there is such a study, but I would guess that it is in sort of systematizing fields. So I would imagine there are a lot of people in engineering, a lot of people in the sciences that, you know, create a systematic framework for understanding things. And when it comes to the more sort of humanities or social sciences, I'd expect to see a fair number of somewhat autistic economists, somewhat autistic philosophers, people who are involved in very sort of systematic enterprises.
Baron Cohen finds strong representation in math and engineering.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he looked at all of those other areas, but again, that makes some sense.
Yeah, so what do you make of that? It just occurred to me there's this whole, I don't know if it's French, there's like the Society for Post-Autistic Economics, and autistic there is used as a pejorative, I think.
Well, they changed the name. A lot of autistic people complained.
Oh, did they?
And complained on websites, and I think wrote to them.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, they changed the name, but they didn't change their explanatory statement.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, again, a simple example of how a term which refers to real human beings who are reading this stuff is used in a very pejorative way. And even in today's era of political correctness, now that I've started noticing it, I'm continually astonished how frequently it happens and how acceptable it is, like, to insult other people just by calling them autistic in some way. And that's another example.
Well, Tyler, it looks like our time's about up. Let me give you a chance to put in a last word. If you were going to say anything that would describe your book or would tell people why they should buy it, go for it.
Well, I'd say this, Will. You're one of my favorite public intellectuals. And if all you people out there listening want to buy a book written by someone who, as Will, is one of his favorite public intellectuals, you should buy my book. How's that?
That's really sweet. I don't know what to say to that, but thank you very much. It was a great book. I really found it profoundly interesting and stimulating in a way that most sort of big think books aren't. It's by Tyler Cowen. It's Create Your Own Economy, The Path to Prosperity in a Disordered World. Thanks so much, Tyler. That was fun.
It's been a great chat. Thanks for having me on, and thanks to Peter for making it possible.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.